On the show today, a groundbreaking decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
President Biden, hours after the Supreme Court's ruling, said schools of higher education should keep a commitment to ensure their students come from diverse backgrounds that reflect all of America.
Plus, street clashes in France.
In Nanterre, where the incident took place, cars were set on fire. And protesters set up road barricades, hurling projectiles at lines of police. Riot police fired back with tear gas.
And we'll hear from the EU summit and learn how the ongoing screenwriter strike is affecting the Hollywood economy. Today is Friday, June 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. As the EU summit continues in Brussels, European Union leaders are expected to assess Russian President Vladimir Putin's position in talks with the head of NATO and Ukraine's president. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
On arriving at the summit, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg commented on the weekend revolt in Russia.
The mutiny we saw at the weekend demonstrates that there are cracks and divisions within the Russian system.
Finnish Prime Minister Petteri Orpo said he's cautiously monitoring the situation, even more so now that Finland is a member of NATO.
We don't know exactly what is happening in Russia in the near future or in future. That's why we have to strengthen our border.
Latvia's Prime Minister Kristianis Kariņš was concerned about the influx of Wagner mercenaries into Europe after their leader found asylum in Belarus.
We keep a wary eye on everything that occurs in Belarus with Prigozhin there.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen believed that although under control now, the revolt of Wagner mercenaries on Putin's government will cause aftershocks on Putin's rule. I'm Karen Chamas.
In a related story, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg's term will be extended again as NATO members seek consistency amid the war in Ukraine and tension with Russia. And speaking of Ukraine, former U.S. Vice President and current Republican candidate Mike Pence was in Kyiv on Thursday to visit Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
We need to make sure that we provide the Ukrainian military what they need to push back on and defeat Russian aggression here, because it will make it clear to Russia, to China, and to any other nations in the world that would seek to redraw international lines by force, that the free world will not stand for it. The free world will stand together for freedom.
The visit is symbolic, as Pence is not in government, but it allows him to differentiate himself from Republican hopefuls who would seek to cut aid and support to Kyiv. All this while the Kremlin said it could not provide information about Russian General Sergei Surovikin, who has not been seen in public since Saturday, when Wagner mercenary group head Yevgeny Prigozhin led a mutiny attempt against the Russian military. Top Russian and U.S. officials have said Surovikin appears to have been detained, according to media reports on Thursday. On Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court decisively struck down the use of affirmative action in college admissions, ruling that consideration of a student's race to help decide who is admitted to colleges and universities is unconstitutional. It's been a controversial social issue in the U.S. for much of the past 20 years, with multiple attempts at changing the law. President Joe Biden is calling the ruling a severe disappointment, but says it cannot become a permanent setback for diversity in education. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman is at the Supreme Court and has the details.
President Biden, hours after the Supreme Court's ruling, said schools of higher education should keep a commitment to ensure their students come from diverse backgrounds that reflect all of America. Speaking at the White House, the president expressed concern the decision by the justices overturning decades of precedent could have ramifications beyond the classroom.
Companies who are already realizing the value of diversity should not use this decision as an excuse to turn away from diversity either.
Republicans are applauding the ruling. Former President Donald Trump, the party's frontrunner in next year's primary election for the presidency, says the decision means people with extraordinary ability and everything else necessary for success, including future greatness for our country, are finally being rewarded. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the Supreme Court.
And joining us to provide additional context on Thursday's ruling is Joel Paul. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of California College of Law in San Francisco.
Since the 1970s, it has been quite common for colleges and universities in the United States to practice affirmative action in order to create a more diverse educational environment. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Bakke, said that this was permissible for the purposes of adding diversity in education because it helped to better prepare students for society in general. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld challenges to race-based affirmative action over the decades, as recently as 20 years ago. But in the most recent case 20 years ago, the Supreme Court said that they thought that after 25 years, that we were becoming a more racially diverse society and a more just society, and then it wouldn't be necessary to continue this policy in perpetuity, but that, you know, within the next 25 years, the court suggested that affirmative action should end. And so what the court said today is that the time has come for ending race-based affirmative action.
How does the idea of affirmative action, using race as one of the factors in admissions, how does that square with the idea that all people are created equal?
Well, the Supreme Court said that race could not be used as the deciding factor, the determinative factor. In Bakke, the Supreme Court said that race could be used as a factor in addition to things like people's performance on exams, their undergraduate records, their school sports, whether they were the son or daughter of an alumnus of the college and so forth, that all these factors could be sort of added together and that race could be one among many plus factors. So it wasn't a case of outright discrimination based on race, but that rather race might be considered a plus factor in the same way that, you know, having a student applying from a rural community, which you don't normally have applicants from, might add to the diversity of the college because you have people with different experiences and different perspectives.
Now, the role of what they're calling DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is one of the social hot buttons, one of the culture war issues, especially as we get into election season. Is this ruling specifically limited to colleges and university admission, or is it for all kinds of schools, for businesses? What are the limits of Thursday's ruling?
Well, that's a good question, and it's not entirely clear. The Supreme Court says something very curious at the end of the decision. They say that while they're addressing today the question about diversity in higher education, they're not going to address here the question about diversity in, for example, the military. They said that the military might have more compelling reasons for having race-based affirmative action, for example, in their officer corps. You know, that suggests to me that there might be exceptions. One example would be if you're trying to ensure integration in a school district, a public school district, grades kindergarten through 12, in that case, it's quite common for courts to consider the race of different students to ensure that the school is sufficiently integrated. And so there might be cases in which race could be a factor.
Joel Paul is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California College of Law in San Francisco. Professor, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for helping us understand this complicated ruling.
It's been my pleasure. You take care.
Protesters clashed with riot police on the sidelines of a march held on Thursday in tribute to a 17-year-old killed by police earlier this week in a Paris suburb. Reuters' Christy Kilburn reports.
Unrest erupted again on Thursday in France, marking the third day of clashes over the deadly police shooting of a teenager. In Nanterre, where the incident took place, cars were set on fire, and protesters set up road barricades, hurling projectiles at lines of police. Riot police fired back with tear gas. Earlier in the day, there had been a largely peaceful march for the victim, identified as 17-year-old Nael of North African descent. He was shot dead during a traffic stop, and public anger over the incident led to riots across France this week. The teenager's mother chanted "Justice for Nael" with other supporters in the march. Karima Katem, a local councillor in Blanc-Mesnil, northeast of Paris, says people's patience is running thin.
I think we owe this today to Nael. There have already been so many like him before, and we don't want any more. By killing Nael, they killed our child.
Earlier, President Emmanuel Macron held a crisis meeting with senior ministers over the shooting and condemned the unrest. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin said 40,000 police officers would be deployed across the country on Thursday. That's nearly four times the numbers mobilized the previous day. A video shared on social media, verified by Reuters, shows two police officers beside a Mercedes AMG car, with one shooting at the teenage driver at close range as he pulled away. He died shortly afterwards from his wounds. A Nanterre prosecutor said the officer involved had been put under formal investigation for voluntary homicide. The officer has acknowledged firing a lethal shot, the prosecutors added, telling investigators he wanted to prevent a car chase after the teenager allegedly committed several traffic violations. The incident has fed long-standing complaints of police violence and systemic racism inside law enforcement agencies from rights groups and within the low-income, racially mixed suburbs across the country. Authorities deny the accusations.
That's Reuters' Christy Kilburn reporting. And here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims braved intense heat to perform the symbolic stoning of the devil during the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, where morning temperatures rose past 42 degrees Celsius. Members of the UN's cultural agency began gathering Thursday for the start of 2 days of meetings in Paris that are expected to include a vote to accept the return of the United States to the organization. The U.S. withdrew in 2018, complaining of anti-Israel bias and mismanagement at the agency. Aspartame, one of the world's most common artificial sweeteners, will be declared a possible carcinogen by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a leading global health body. Aspartame is commonly used in products from diet sodas to chewing gum and other sugar-free snacks and drinks. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Gravitational waves are considered ripples in the fabric of space-time by the science community. The first Einstein-predicted gravitational waves were detected in 2015 by the LIGO and Virgo scientific collaborations. Scientists have now found evidence that Earth and the universe are surrounded by a background hum of ultra-low-frequency gravitational waves. The LIGO-Virgo-detected waves were said to oscillate at frequencies of about 100 cycles per second. By comparison, Caltech's Katerina Chatsianu says in an email that these gravitational waves oscillate once over years or decades. This discovery was based on 15 years of multiple radio telescope observations by the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his government will drop an important part of the controversial judicial reform plans, which have roiled Israel with protests. He told the Wall Street Journal he'd no longer seek to give Parliament the power to override Supreme Court rulings. His critics remain skeptical. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he has dropped a central element of a bitterly contested overhaul of the judiciary that has sparked months of mass protests. like this one last weekend. He told the Wall Street Journal in an interview posted on Thursday he'd scrap the so-called override clause, which would grant Parliament the authority to overturn Supreme Court rulings. His nationalist religious government would still pursue changes, though, to how judges are selected.
Well, I already changed a few things right after the original proposal was put forward. I said that the idea of an override clause where the Parliament, the Knesset, can override the decisions of the Supreme Court with a simple majority, I threw that out.
Netanyahu's remarks upset the far-right police minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who accused him of caving to protesters. The news knocked the Israeli shekel. An analyst told Reuters that was because it confirmed Netanyahu was still pressing ahead. The judicial overhaul has raised concern in the United States and other allies about the health of Israel's democracy. Domestic critics see it as an attempt to curb judicial independence by Netanyahu, who is on trial on corruption charges he denies. Netanyahu paused the plan in late March for compromise talks with the opposition. But those talks were suspended this month, and Netanyahu's coalition began work this week on a new bill.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us today. About 180,000 Zimbabweans working in South Africa who face the threat of being kicked out of the country, even if their children are citizens, have welcomed a court ruling preventing that. Pretoria's High Court ruled the government's plan to terminate their special residency permits was unconstitutional. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The High Court's decision is a blow to South Africa's Home Affairs Ministry and a win for Zimbabweans, many of whom have been in South Africa for more than a decade, having left neighbouring Zimbabwe amid political and economic turmoil during former President Robert Mugabe's rule. To deal with the influx from across the border, South Africa initially introduced special permits to allow them to work, but in 2021 said it was ending the programme. The Zimbabwe Immigration Federation challenged the government's intention to force Zimbabweans to return home, and the group's chairman, Luke Shviti, on Thursday welcomed the court's verdict.
I welcome with two hands the judgment ended yesterday by the High Court of South Africa in the favor of our organization, Zimbabwe Immigration Federation. And such stance or gesture shows that justice is still prevailing in the Republic of South Africa. And we are grateful because there was going to be a humanitarian disaster.
Shviti said the ending of the Zimbabwe exemption permits would have caused a huge exodus and meant many families in Zimbabwe being supported by a breadwinner in South Africa would have been pushed into greater poverty. The court ruled that the permits would be extended for one more year. After that, Shviti said his organization would launch another application. Silas Sabanda is a driver who has been living in South Africa for about 20 years and currently holds an exemption permit.
When there was no verdict yet, we remember we were still in the dark. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't move. We were worried that maybe we'd lose whatever we'd done, especially for those who had jobs and who were working. But at least now we are given the space so we can do things properly and proper planning as well. So it was a big relief for most of us.
As Africa's most industrialized economy, South Africa is a favored destination for Zimbabweans and other migrants from the continent. There have been incidents of xenophobic violence, however, with South Africans targeting other African nationals. Last year, a Zimbabwean man in Johannesburg was killed by a mob. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And finally today, a screenwriter's strike in Hollywood has been going on for 2 months, grinding scripted TV production to a halt and costing California millions of dollars of losses each day. Angela Bagdasarian has more, narrated for us by Anna Rice.
Since early May, screenwriters in Hollywood have been a daily sight outside movie studios from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., signs in hand and demanding better pay. Hollywood screenwriter Stuart Beatty, who wrote scripts for The Pirates of the Caribbean and I, Frankenstein, says his life was thrown off course, and instead of writing scripts, he is now busy protesting daily, fighting for his rights.
None of us want to be here. We'd all much rather be telling stories, but we've been forced to come out here by the studios.
Beatty took his son, a future screenwriter as well, to the strike with him. During the last series of strikes back in 2007, the two went together as well.
In 07, I had my son with me there in 07. He was much smaller then, and now he's much bigger, so that's one difference. But back in 07, I had to explain to people why we were striking. People didn't understand, and some people were even angry at us for striking.
That 2007 strike, according to the Milken Institute, cost California roughly $2 billion. This strike, according to the Writers Guild, is costing California and Hollywood about $30 million a day in lost revenue. California's small businesses are suffering too. Milt and Eddie's Dry Cleaners is in a tough spot as well. Before the strike, General Manager Robert Shapiro says many major studios would come to take care of costumes.
We've definitely seen a downturn in our entertainment business, primarily because we hear that a lot of the shows have stopped filming. And as a result, we're seeing a lot less stylists, costumers come in.
Restaurant and makeup artists are losing money as well. So are hairdressers, florists, decorators, and electricians. For now, there is no sign how long the strike could last. No talks between the studios and writers are scheduled, and there is a chance members of the Screen Actors Guild could go on strike too. Their contract expires Friday. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, California, NRI's VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Gulf of Guinea, an 11,000 square kilometer or 4,247 square mile body of water in West Africa, is one of the world's most dangerous shipping routes, according to the International Maritime Bureau. This is largely due to piracy, which has claimed numerous lives, destabilizing the region and costs nearly $2 billion in financial losses per year. And although it has slowly declined over the past few years, piracy has not only continued to be a threat, it has also shown signs of spreading to other regions, according to the United Nations. The United States is committed to the lawful international navigation in and the security and sustainable development of the Gulf of Guinea region and, indeed, the entire Atlantic Ocean basin, said United States Acting Deputy Representative of the United Nations Jeffrey De Laurentiis.
Maritime security in the Gulf of Guinea is essential to maintaining a safe and prosperous Atlantic, both for Atlantic nations and those who depend on its waters for their livelihood. We reaffirm our commitment to assisting states in the region to counter piracy and armed robbery at sea, to holding perpetrators, facilitators, and key figures of criminal networks accountable, and to addressing other related destabilizing and illicit activities in the Gulf of Guinea.
The United States is wholly committed to supporting our partners as they address the grave and persistent threats posed by piracy, armed robbery, and transnational organized crime in the Gulf, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
We further highlight the aim to criminalize and prosecute acts of piracy and armed robbery at sea and emphasize the need to support national, regional, and international efforts to counter piracy and armed robbery in the Gulf of Guinea.
Through the collaborative efforts of many nations, the frequency of piracy has dramatically decreased. We encourage the region to continue its effort to maintain this progress. The United States will continue to be a close partner in doing so, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
Challenges such as piracy, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, transnational organized crime, climate change, pollution, and environmental degradation all remain serious threats to our livelihoods and shared security.
The United States has pledged to increase our collaboration and coordination with nations across the Atlantic, said Ambassador De Laurentiis, so that we may jointly face these most pressing security threats in the Gulf of Guinea and beyond.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.